Good morning, everyone. This is the Senate Veteran Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs, and I'd like to welcome everyone. It's May 14th, Thursday. It's supposed to be a beautiful weekend, and we're almost to the weekend. That's really good. I would like to open a public hearing on HJM 12. Mr. Shook, and would Representative Barton come forward?
Madam Chair, HJM 12 urges Congress to enact legislation increasing veterans' access to health care.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
The committee. Thank you very much for having me over today and for hearing this memorial. But so I, 5 months ago, it seems like a long time ago, before I was sworn in to the House of Representatives.
Now, who's
for the record, my name is Brett Barton.
Good.
I represent House District 51, which is East Clackamas County. About 5 months ago, I was a member of this chamber, a more seasoned person, gave me some advice to never really get carried away on memorials or resolutions. and it didn't take me long, I suppose, to promptly ignore that advice. And it came from, again, this side, so it was probably good advice. But I'm doing so on HJM 12, I suppose, for two reasons. One is the importance of the topic, i.e., access to transportation for our rural veterans. And two is the timing. This memorial coincides with legislation that's been sponsored by Senator Wyden. And this is really an opportunity for us, I think, to frame the issue, to bring attention to the issue of transportation for rural veterans, and keep moving this ball forward in some small way. So I appreciate your hearing it today. As this committee probably knows, Oregon currently has 10 community-based outpatient clinics in which rural veterans can receive access to primary health care and mental health services. However, in the event they need to see a specialist, they have to go to one of two locations, of course, Portland or Roseburg. And the transportation to get from anywhere in rural Oregon to one of those two locations can be challenging. There are a variety of volunteer organizations, all of which have significant imperfections. But this issue can be addressed, and HJM 12 urges Congress to increase the reimbursement for transportation mileage, which is particularly needed for our rural veterans. Thank you for your time.
Do you know what it is now, reimbursement?
Madam Chair, I'm checking my notes. I believe, according to my notes, which can't be wrong, it's 11 cents.
11 cents.
41 and a half cents, I'm told.
And I know the
angel at my shoulder.
And I think mileage for public employees is 48 and a half. 51%? 55 cents. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And I'd also like to thank the folks behind me who actually have details.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
All right. I'll quickly close HJM 12, since we do have someone else to testify on it, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2755. Representative Mason and Mr. Shook.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2755A requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to conduct study of options available for utilizing reinsurance and other mechanisms for spreading risk in individual and small employer group health insurance markets, and to submit a report to the Legislative Assembly by December 1st, 2010.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative for District 13. One of our key challenges beyond access to health care is the cost of health care. It's critical to address the cost. It costs too much, and costs are escalating beyond people's capacity to keep up with the inflation. As more and more Oregonians are uninsured, as you're aware, then the burden falls increasingly on the state to try to make up the gap there. The Department of Consumer and Business Services is the primary regulator of the commercial health insurance market, where roughly 42% of Oregonians get their insurance. From information that I've had supplied from the department, covering the first three quarters of 2008, rates for individual health care plans increased an average of 17.7%, and rates for small group health plans increased an average of 11%. I compare that to inflation for general goods and services, which has been averaging about 3%, and medical inflation has been averaging about 9%. So it really makes you wonder why, when general inflation is just under 3%, medical inflation is 9, why we are seeing the health insurance rate increases requested for 15, 20, and 25% and more. I think it's critical to understand why. This bill will help us understand what is driving the increase in the health insurance market in the rates and see what we can do to help slow it down. Reinsurance is essentially insurance for insurers. It allows the primary insurers to spread the risk with secondary insurers, and the other name for that phrase, secondary insurers, is reinsurers, where many primary insurers currently purchase private reinsurance in order to protect against the risk that policyholders' expenses will unexpectedly exceed their abilities to or what they estimated that they would be paying out. Public reinsurance pooling has currently been adopted or is under review for use in the regulation of private insurance in other states, including New York, Arizona, Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas. We wouldn't be the first to start looking into this. In the ongoing discussions of health care reform in Oregon, the concept of a single reinsurance plan has been identified as a possible way of spreading the risk in the individual and small group markets. Some type of risk spreading or reinsurance mechanism would almost certainly be necessary if we move ahead with an insurance exchange, for example. So how to structure the risk spreading and the reinsurance concept will require analysis that the department is prepared to do. I hope that you've now received a letter from Bruce Mulligan from Eugene, who describes his business experience with this issue. He had testified before in a House committee and was unable to be here this morning. He supports the concept from his business perspective, for example. Later, I hope you will also be hearing testimony from the department about what this would do, how they could accommodate and manage this study, and indicating that there is support for moving ahead with this. So I ask for your vote of yes today. I hope you'll agree that we should put the wheels in motion to start working on this, because I think that we, Oregon's citizens and Oregon's businesses, really can't afford to wait any longer. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Have the reinsurers testified at all on this bill?
To my knowledge, they were not at the previous hearing.
They must not have a lobbyist. All right. With that, thank you very much. Is there any questions? And thank you for coming to me to talk to me about this bill ahead of time.
Thank you.
Appreciate
very much.
It. All right. With that, Teresa Miller, Rocky King, and Janine Smith.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Janine Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research. House Bill 2755 furthers the work and recommendations of the Oregon Health Fund Board, which my office staffed, and can provide the state more options to consider expanding access to Oregonians. Carol Robinson will be here in a few seconds as it comes off the printer, but we have a letter from the Oregon Health Fund in support of this bill for you. Many health plans purchase private reinsurance to protect themselves from unexpected large numbers of high-cost insurance claims and for other business reasons. A purchaser of health coverage, particularly for groups or individuals who would be newly insured, oftentimes pay for the insurer's fear of risk or potentially expensive costs greater than expected. By sharing in the payment of some portion of the claims through a reinsurance mechanism, some states have looked at it as a means of bringing down the costs of buying and coverage. Since 2001, New York State has had a Healthy New York, which is a program of state-funded reinsurance. It has grown to cover almost 150,000 people, including many small groups, who are now able to purchase insurance that has significantly lower-priced premiums than if buying outside of the program. New York actually buys more of a middle corridor of risk, and I've attached a diagram at the end of the testimony summarizing their approach. So, diagram on the back, where they actually, while many reinsurers will buy the upper highest claims, New York's approach has been to buy sort of a middle range of claims. Because of New York's efforts, reinsurance has been actively discussed at numerous national meetings with other states. Staff from Rocky King's shop, the Office of Private Health Partnerships, and myself have participated in a reinsurance institute sponsored by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation over the last year or so to look at what these other states are doing and what are the best practices and to avoid the pitfalls of the other states, as this is a means to lower the cost of health care insurance and expand access. The foundation funded modeling of three states, Wisconsin, Rhode Island, and Washington State, to better help understand the unique features of the different state markets and estimate the impacts of the approach. Some of the findings in that three-state modeling was reinsurance from state support did expand coverage among the previously uninsured. Premium reduction of about one-third were noted overall, varying by the different assumptions made and the differences between the states. Most of the impact incurred because of increased employer offers of coverage. It solidified existing coverage by making it less likely that small employers would drop coverage and allowing some people with individual coverage to switch to group coverage by bringing down the rates that their employers were offering. Healthy New York's efforts focused on the previously uninsured, but this newer modeling, which included Washington State, suggests that this could be also a mechanism to sustain employers' efforts to offer insurance to their employees. In efforts to recommend strategies to make health care more affordable for healthy and high-risk Oregonians and to aim to keep insurance rates stable over time, the Oregon Health Fund Board, through the work of the Insurance Exchange Workgroup and Finance Committee, developed many recommendations for market changes within the comprehensive health reform recommendations. To encourage carriers' participation in the exchange, the board recommended there should be a look at reinsurance or other risk-sharing arrangements, and that will be summarized in the letter you'll be receiving. But they really think that further work is necessary to develop a solution that lower costs for small businesses and individuals seeking to obtain or maintain health insurance. Expanding access to health care services to achieve the board's aim for affordable, quality health care for all Oregonians is critical, and it's a great next step towards a healthy Oregon.
I think it's unbelievable that premium reductions of about one-third were noted in the three states.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, yes, that was from modeling, though. I mean, it hasn't been implemented in those three states yet, but that's by looking at the numbers, that's what they proposed could happen. And
so do you think it will actually happen?
Well, New York has been able to keep 150,000 people having insurance by their approach.
But so has the premiums? I mean, you said the premiums went up because of... Well, explain about what New York again.
Well, New York bought the middle claims,
yes,
as opposed to the higher claims, and they actually adjusted that corridor down. They originally bought a slightly higher corridor of claims and then found over time that the most of the that really helped keep the premium down was to buy the lower one, which is, I think, $5,000 to $75,000 claims. So it's just a very fascinating approach that I think what this bill does is allows us to look at it, see how it would work or fit with Oregon, and what's the best approach to do it, and learn from the experiences in New York and the other few states that have started to do it.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I'm just curious. The New York programs have been in place for a decade. 150,000 people is almost a rounding error relative to their population. So how can you say it's a success?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, these are folks who are above the Medicaid eligibility and otherwise would be uninsured in that state. So, in again, thinking how large of a population New York is, it is a small number, but it is a start towards small business employees to be able to have access to something, which is a kind of a big gap in many states, including Oregon, where we have coverage for the very low income, and then we have the coverage up higher, but there's this gap population, and there's multiple approaches many states have tried. This is one that's been ongoing for a period of time that it has been successful in terms of at least 150,000 people less uninsured.
So with this bill, you, along with the Department of Consumer and Business, or would it be the Office of Private Partnerships,
be working
all of us.
All of the above. Would be doing a study, a modeling, to see what could happen in the state.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, yes, we would, our multiple wisdoms from all the offices would put our heads together and look and see what we could, what kind of approaches could be applied, what, how is reinsurance applied and used both in the private market, in these state examples, et cetera, and really come back to you with some recommendations on how best to apply it.
Senator Morris?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reference is to New York's program, and it's state-funded. Do you have information with respect to how much the state has invested in this program?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Morris, there is a lot of detail. That was part of the Reinsurance Institute I went to, where they went through very detailed of what they did, how they started, what their small first initial investments were, and where they are. So I can provide you with that. That also would be part of what would be coming back in the report is, you know, where are they, you know, what did they learn from as they went forward, you know, what would be the costs to the state. If one chose to go this approach,
it would be very, if I may, Madam Chair, it would be very interesting to see what they had to capitalize this effort, because if I was to come to DCBS to get licensed as an insurance company in this state to offer reinsurance, that's a pretty high threshold. And how this would compare to something like that, so that it's actuarially sound.
Okay. Yes, Senator Morissette.
The potential benefit is like asks as a subsidy or like a subsidy for insurance. I'm talking about a different kind of insured. That would be the adult foster homes, who cannot get reasonable insurance. Are there reinsurance programs for liability for instance, adult foster homes? Many of them not only can't get liability insurance, they can't get homeowners insurance, because if they don't have liability, the insurance company won't insure them. So there are those out there, those that I'm familiar with that simply are hoping that they never need it. And I've looked at different states that may have, you know, that I thought had some programs, but I don't know what the situation is in Teresa. Maybe we can talk about that later. But to me, that's an important area.
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, for the record, Teresa Miller, acting administrator for the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. My memory is failing me, but I want to say this is actually an issue that we at the division looked into at some point in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And so if you'll allow me, I'd like to go back and talk to our folks and see what we learned, because I do think this is something that we had taken a look at.
I've raised this issue over the last few years, yes.
Perhaps that's why we were looking into it. So let me go back and look
at
that.
Thanks.
And it could be that the insurers don't want to insure because they don't have reinsurance that would address that issue.
Madam Chair, I know we looked at this.
Yeah, that I think is the problem. Good. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, on House Bill 2755, I don't have too much to add to what Representative Nathanson and Dr. Smith have said. I mean, we're very much looking forward to working with both the Office of Private Health Partnership and the Office of Health Policy and Research to look at what other states have done in this area, both in the individual and small employer group market. And I think this is a very important discussion to have, particularly in light of the conversations that will be taking place over the next few years around just reforming Oregon's healthcare system. So we are looking forward to working on this and looking forward to bringing some recommendations back to you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool and also the Office of Private Health Partnerships. And as Teresa and Dr. Smith have said, we are supportive of this bill, think it's a smart thing at this time, given the reforms both on a national and local level that people are talking about, to look at different mechanisms for spreading the risk. As you know, the high-risk pool is a risk-spreading mechanism currently today. the individual market where people are denied coverage because of previous or pre-existing medical conditions. People are then put into the we take those losses and spread them to about 1.6 million Oregonians in the insured market. Rather than seeding people, what I think this bill does is say, how do you seed the risk so you don't move people around, but you move that risk around a little more equitably than I think it's done today. So we support this study. It's not implementing anything. It's really coming back to the legislature with some ideas that will then fit with some of the discussion around the major reforms that are going on, both, again, on the national and local level.
Why did the... why isn't there a fiscal on this?
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, when discussing this with my two compatriots here, we felt that amongst the three offices, we could absorb the staffing of this, and then we would, this is one of those potential opportunities to try and get some grant dollars to perhaps pay for the modeling through the, there's a grant coming up from the federal government on state health reform and coverage options, and this would be an ideal, and actually is mentioned, I think, in the guidance as one of the things that they would encourage us to apply to get some funding for. So we're looking to see how to structure that, but that would allow us to do something like the modeling that was done for Washington and state and Wisconsin. Alternatively, would be, of course, we know it's tough economic times, and if you'd like to give us additional dollars, we would gladly accept them.
They aren't there. this could definitely be a step toward healthcare cost containment.
And I just wanted to add that we felt that also within the fiscal that was proposed for 2009/856, there's a lot of some dollars in there as well. So say we didn't get that additional grant dollars, it's part of the work around developing a health insurance exchange business plan. Looking at risk spreading mechanisms such as this would be part of that work. So we felt that in many ways that if 2009 passed, we definitely would have resources to be able to do an adequate full study.
Okay. Yes, Sam.
As a follow-up, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm skeptical. Okay. And I would be curious if New York applied the same standards for soundness to their state plan that they apply to the third party insurance.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, my understanding of New York is that they put out bids for the normally licensed and fully funded health insurers to participate with them, but they act as buying a certain number of those claims, and so they're working with licensed, the normal health plans that are already operating in their state. It's just that instead of those plans paying for every single claim that comes in, the state buys a certain a number of those claims. So that takes the bid is lower because they're not responsible for that smaller subsection of claims. So it is a slightly different approach than the traditional, here's the health insurer and then reinsurance. These plans still have a reinsurer that takes the very, very highest claims for them. But they found over time that a lot of the cost and the high risk was, that seemed to keep the rates down, was if the state bought that middle corridor.
Have they, as follow-up, have they actually subsidized those rates in New York?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, they buy the claims from 5,000 to 75,000 come into the state. All the other claims go to the insurance company. And then the bid that comes back from the insurance company every year is lower than it would be if the state wasn't buying that set of claims. The money that they had tobacco settlement dollars back in 2000, and that's what they were using and have been continued to use to buy that middle corridor with.
So if I'm understanding it, it is a subsidy.
It's a different way. Instead of in as we do in FEOP, we subsidize the individual. In this case, we're sort of subsidizing a whole group of individuals through this reinsurance mechanism.
Madam Chair, again, Rocky King, I'm the administrator for OMIP. Let me talk a little about OMIP because I think that kind of will help look at it. Right now, we have 15,000 people in OMIP. If we go to a market for...
And just explain for the record what that is.
Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, that's where people who have pre-existing conditions and are turned down in the individual market come to us for coverage. Now, for every dollar in premium they pay, and they pay basically about 115% of a standard premium. So these are folks that put up generally their own money. But for every dollar we get in premium, we expend about $2 in claims. So what do? With that $80 million of losses that we have each year, we take that and spread that through the entire insured market, about 1.6 million folks. And that comes out to about $4.75 per month per covered life, whether it's ODS, Kaiser, Blue Cross, whoever it may be. Part of their premium includes that surcharge to help support those high-risk individuals, cancer, multiple sclerosis, really the folks that are the sickest of the sick. Now, if you go to, for example, a guaranteed issue market where everybody can get access to coverage irrespective of their health condition, then the risk of that gets associated with which market they go to. If all of our 15,000 people went to, for example, the individual market because they don't have group coverage available, you would see premiums in the individual market. Rather than being $4.75, they may be as high as $70 or $80 or $90 higher just because you're putting those folks into that pool. All we're talking about in studying reinsurance is figuring out how you can spread the risks of all these folks, the small group and the individual, to the largest pool possible. I mean, that's the whole theory of insurance. The bigger the pool, the better it is, and that can even out some of those problems that come up when you have the high-risk folks. The small group market and the individual is the most challenging because generally you have people that anticipate higher healthcare costs trying to access those. That's different than the large group market where almost everybody has the coverage available, sick, not sick, young, old. But especially in the individual market, you will see a higher proportion of people trying to get into that market because they think they have high healthcare costs coming down the road. So this is just a way to look at those mechanisms. Senator Morris, you raised one mechanism is, yes, the state could come forward and say to help. We're going to help subsidize some of the actual claim costs in a corridor. It could be that you just set up a reinsurance mechanism similar to what the state had in the 1990s in the small group market. When we went to guaranteed issue in the small group market, we set up a reinsurance pool for small groups where they actually put some money, all the insurers put some money in and said, we're going to be able to seed individual lives. And now it wasn't used very effectively. It was based on a model going back to the 80s, so it eventually went away. And what we're saying is let's go back in today's world and relook at that. I don't know if that...
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I would like to move the bill if there isn't any strong opposition at this point in time.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Move it to the floor, to Ways and Means, to the floor.
To the floor.
Good. With funds available.
Especially since we could take advantage of federal funds, and especially since the Oregon Health Fund Board has given a recommendation, and this is all a part of the cost containment, which is extremely important.
Sure. Yeah. Now, did you say that when 2009 passes, there will be funding available within that?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Morissette, in the body of work to do a health insurance exchange business plan, this is one of those risk-sharing approaches that would need to be looked at as we develop that. So there is dollars in 2009 set aside that this would be part of that work, in addition to the staff work that we would just do amongst ourselves.
It did pass the House 57 votes to 2. All right. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2755 and open a work session on House Bill 2755.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2755 to the floor to do pass the recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2755A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I find this troubling. All the things we are tasking at this point in time, and we're still ignoring the fact that the biggest driver in the cost of insurance is utilization. And I'm not sure this gets us there. I'm troubled by the New York model that has been in place for 10 years and appears to have not accomplished much. And the other states, it's simply modeling. And when you use static models to determine outcomes, you're usually wrong. So for those reasons, I cannot support it because I think we've got enough work already to do.
Thank you. I appreciate your comment, Senator Cruz. I just view from the fact if we do nothing, then nothing is going to change the out-of-control health care system that we have right now. Any other comments?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I was a few minutes late. I was down at LFO, and I also spent some of the morning filling out the Oregon Physician Workforce Survey for Dr. Janine Smith. It's available to you now. Come again anytime you like. Yeah, one of them. It seems a bit, when I read it last, I looked through it, it does seem a bit redundant, but I think it just gives extra emphasis to get this kind of work done through House Bill 2009 and through whatever new entity or entity we use. There's no physical attached to it that I can see other than possible grant money if it becomes available, but I also support what Senator Cruz is saying. It doesn't really get to the meat of the problem, which is utilization and health care costs, which you're speaking to also. So we'll pass it forward, but let's not get ourselves, this is not the answer. It's just a step in the right direction.
Okay. Any other comments? The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Senator Morris.
Aye.
Chair Cruz.
No.
Chair Miles Anderson.
Aye. Motion carries, and I'll carry the bill, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2755 and open a public hearing on HJM 12. Paul Brown.
Madam Chair.
Paul.
HJM 12.
We already did it.
12? We already did 12.
39.
No,
seven.
Back to 12.
Yeah, back to 12.
Urges Congress to enact legislation increasing veterans' access to health care.
Yes.
Paula.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here today in support of HJM 12, which urges Congress to increase the travel reimbursement rate for Oregon veterans who travel great distances to reach VA medical facilities. During the Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services statewide tour, the task force learned that transportation to VA medical centers is a significant issue for veterans living in rural and remote Oregon. One way we hope to ameliorate this transportation problem is to increase the travel reimbursement to veterans living farther away from VA medical facilities. Currently, the VA travel reimbursement rate is 41.5 cents per mile. The reimbursement rate for the state of Oregon and the federal government is 55 cents a mile. Already, veterans are behind the going rate. Then you add on top of that veterans who have to travel 100 miles or more to get to a VA medical facility, and you quickly begin to realize the reimbursement rate does not meet the expense a veteran will incur to travel to the facility to receive the care they need. HJM 12 urges Congress to realize this fact and increase the reimbursement rate for veterans traveling longer distances due to their increased costs. We believe HJM 12 is a good common sense memorial that asks Congress to do the right thing for veterans. Thank you for your consideration, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on HJM 12 and open a work session on HJM 12.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 12 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves HJM 12 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And who's on the bill? I didn't look. Or is this come from the town? Is there any senators? Oh, Senator Boquist is on this bill, so we'll have him carry it.
Okay.
All right, with that, I'll close the work session on HJM 12, and I'll open a public hearing on HJM 21.
Madam Chair, HJM 21 urges Congress to change funding of veterans health care from discretionary entitlement to permanent and direct entitlement.
Is there anyone here? Paula Brown again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here today in support of HJM 21, which urges Congress to make Veterans Health Care Administration funding permanent instead of discretionary. The Department of Veterans Affairs medical system is one of the few federal health care programs that is discretionary, which means that Congress annually arbitrarily sets the funding limit for those programs. If the funding is exhausted before the end of the fiscal year, the services are curtailed. What is needed is a mandatory or guaranteed funding mechanism that ensures veterans get the health care that they need. HJM 21 urges our congressional delegation to make funding for the Veterans Health Administration mandatory instead of discretionary so that veterans are guaranteed the level of care that they have earned. This is especially important for our rural and remote Oregon. We have discussed this issue with Senator Merkley and have asked Senator Merkley to champion this issue and other VA health care issues in the Senate. HJM 21 is a good bill that simply asks Congress to keep its promise to veterans. I appreciate your consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any discussion? All right. Are you here for HJM 32? Okay, just stay there then. Right. With that, I'll close public hearing on HJM 21 and open work session on HJM 21.
I'm trying to move HJM 21 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves HJM 21 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, and who would like to carry this bill? Senator Morissette will carry this bill. With that, I'll close the work session on HJM 21, and I'll open public hearing on HJM 3.
Madam Chair, HJM 3 urges Congress to increase funding and eligibility for fee basis payment for veterans, review and simplify the fee basis statutes and regulations regarding payment eligibility for specialty and emergency health care for veterans.
All right, Paula Brown again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here today in support of HJM 3, which urges Congress to increase the funding for the Veterans Health Administration fee basis program, as well as simplify the fee basis rules. As you know, the Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services toured 24 cities between June and August of 2008, holding town hall meetings where veterans could discuss issues affecting their lives. At least one veteran in every town hall meeting told the task force about his or her dissatisfaction with the Veterans Health Administration's fee basis system. Fee basis is the VA's health care's contract payment system used to pay local health care providers outside the VA system to deliver care to veterans who otherwise cannot access VA health care. The problem with the program is limited resources and its complicated system of rules that confuse veterans regarding eligibility and coverage. The VA spends millions of dollars on fee bases in Oregon each year. However, its current spending does not meet the need for a state such as Oregon, where veterans live literally hundreds of miles from a VA facility. The only realistic way for these veterans to get the care they need is to have their care provided at the local level through fee basis. It's true that the VA has done a tremendous job of putting outpatient clinics closer to veterans. In fact, the VA has established 10 of these clinics and has plans for more in Oregon. However, these clinics are for primary care and limited mental health. For most service-connected disabled veterans, they have conditions that require specialty care, Within the VA system, a veteran must travel to a VA hospital to receive that specialty care, which means they have to travel to Portland, Roseburg, or Walla Walla. If you have a World War II veteran in Bend or Gold Beach, traveling to Portland or Roseburg becomes a significant hardship. HDM 3 realizes that Oregon veterans should receive the same level of care no matter where they choose to live. HDM 3 asked Congress to provide more money for fee bases. It asked Congress to review and simplify the laws and regulations regarding payment eligibility for specialty and emergency care for veterans. These two steps will help Oregon veterans in rural and remote Oregon obtain the care they need and have earned when they cannot access a VA medical facility. And, I mean, we can just take a look at Oregon. Oregon is different from many of the states that we have across this country because we do have those rural and remote areas, and it makes it very difficult to get through the passes sometimes. So thank you very much for your consideration, and I would be more than happy to answer any questions.
Any discussion?
Madam Chair, a few comments if I could.
Yes,
this is something I'm very aware of in Southern Oregon and with my veterans there. I've got people from World War II, Vietnam. I think of one particular individual who has shrapnel on his left side and is partially paralyzed on the left side and has a chronic wound for him. It's been there since the 1970s. He has to commonly travel to Portland to get treatment, and it's difficult for him to travel. If you go in the airport at Medford on a Monday morning, you'll find four or five veterans trying to get on a plane to get up to the VA facilities up in Portland. It's a real difficult thing for them, and they just can't access local good care, what's readily available, because of these programs not being properly funded. I realize the VA is trying to do the best it can, but even in primary care, there's gaps in the system. I've got diabetic patients who should be seen every 90 days, four times a year. They're only seen once or twice a year, and I pick up the gap in my office trying to take care of them, and then trying to interface with the VA system, which is extremely difficult to do, to get information back and forth. So there's a lot of barriers here for our veterans, and some of it will be solved by this kind of a program coming forward and being properly funded by the federal government. I know we don't have control here, but this is what is really a serious problem. The other issue that I believe is going to be facing us the next year with veterans is the present veterans we have are a different group of men and women. If you look at the demographics of these people, there's a disproportionate number coming from rural America, not from the big cities. If you looked at what Senator Boquist gave us a couple days ago, I wrote down the number of Oregonians who had been killed in the recent conflicts, and about 60%, I think, maybe a little more, actually came from rural Oregon, and that is not where our population is. So these people are going to go back to their rural communities and not get the VA treatment that they need. This war and the wars we're fighting are being fought in the back of good people from rural Oregon, moderate and low income, who are in the service doing the best they can and doing a great job for us, and we are not taking care of them properly when they come back out. And some of that is because of the rural nature of our state. Other states are facing the same issues, so I appreciate you bringing this forward. Thank you. And, Madam Chair, thank you for indulging me.
No problem. Any other discussion? All right. I'll close the public hearing on HJM 3, and I'll open a work session on HJM 3.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 3 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves HJM 3 to the floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, and would you like to carry it, Senator Bates?
All
right,
yes, thank
Senator
you.
Bates will carry it, and we will close the work session on HJM 3 and open a public hearing on 2177.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2177 permits Department of Veterans Affairs to receive monetary and non-monetary grants, donations, and gifts.
Okay. Paula Brown again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown, the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2177, which is an agency housekeeping bill drafted to allow the Department of Veterans Affairs to dispose of non-monetary assets at the discretion of the director. Under current statute, non-monetary gifts received by the department must be converted to cash if the gift cannot be used directly by the department. non-monetary gifts with no value and not useful to the department can be given to people, corporations, or organizations that serve veterans. Under current law, however, the department cannot give these gifts directly to needy veterans, their survivors, or dependents. House Bill 2177 would allow the director, on his own authority, the discretion to provide the non-monetary gifts with or without value to needy veterans, their survivors and dependents, or entities serving veterans. The bill maintains the current process for converting non-monetary gifts to cash should the director determine that such conversion is the most appropriate disposal of the gift. House Bill 2177 is intended to provide the director more flexibility in providing non-monetary gifts such as wheelchairs, clothing, toiletries, and other items directly to needy veterans and those serving veterans. The department sees this bill as a housekeeping bill, and we know of no opposition. And I want to say that, as we say that there's no value, there may be little or no value. We certainly appreciate every donation that we get, and what this would do is allow us to make those direct donations available to veterans, such as the wheelchairs, walkers, and those are items that we often are we do receive through donation. Many we're able to use at the Oregon Veterans Home, but when we do have those additional ones that we don't need, we would like for the director to have the ability to make those available directly to veterans, their dependents, or survivors. And I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
It just seems unbelievable you can't do that now. Senator Cruz, do you have a comment?
No, it's just some things are relatively simple. This is one.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. And if you're here for the next one, you can stay put. I'll close the public hearing on HB 2177 and open a work session on House Bill 2177.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2177 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2177 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. Senator Morris, do you mind carrying this bill? All right, Senator Morris will carry House Bill 2177, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2177 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3470.
Madam Chair, House Bill 3470 defines veteran for purposes of Section 3, Article 11A of Oregon Constitution.
Paula Brown.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for continuing to indulge me and allow me to testify on these bills. For the record, my name is Paula Brown, and I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here in support of House Bill 3470. It is a companion bill to H.J.R. 7, the constitutional amendment to eliminate the 30-year limitation for Oregon Veteran Home Loan Program. In H.J.R. 7, we're doing two things. First, we're eliminating the 30-year restriction for veterans to use the home loan benefit, and second, we're defining a veteran for the purpose of home loan eligibility. To Senate Bill 96, a bill this committee passed early in session to consolidate all the definitions of veteran. However, while working on H.J.R. 7 in the House, Legislative Council noted the need to have a companion bill in order to tie the definition of a veteran in statute to language in the constitutional amendment. House Bill 3470, which is before you today, is that companion bill, and simply is the language from Senate Bill 96, completing the tie to the constitutional amendment. I'm sorry that H.J.R. 7 was not in front of this committee before House Bill 3470, which may have made more sense. However, H.J.R. 7 will be heard in the House Rules Committee on Monday, and we expect it to move to the House floor quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for all that you've done for veterans this session. And we really appreciate that and all that you continue to do, and I will be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I feel the state has woefully neglected its veterans way back since the Vietnam War era, and maybe even with our World War II veterans in some instances. So I'm delighted that our department, Veterans Affairs Department, has been so involved with getting this agenda to us this session. So thank you also.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any discussion on this?
Yeah, Madam Chair. I'm curious as to why HGR 7 has been delayed. Just the process deal? I'm assuming it's okay. Everybody's fine. Okay. maybe Thomas can kind of...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Mann with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. It went through quite a process in the House. It started out in the Veterans Committee and then moved to the Revenue Committee. And then has moved to the Rules Committee, and we are told that it's a priority bill in the House. It's one of their most top things they want to do, and we are assured that it's going to get out of the House and get over here. I am hoping it comes here, and if it doesn't come on time, it'll probably end up in Senate Rules.
Okay.
But does it make sense to pass this if we don't pass that? We could pass this and it wouldn't make any difference.
Correct, because this is contingent upon the passage
of
HJR 7 on the ballot. So if it doesn't pass even on the ballot, this would not take effect.
All right.
So it's okay.
Thank you. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3470 and open a work session on House Bill 3470.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3470 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3470 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Cruz, you want to carry that?
Sure.
I'll close the work session. Did you get that? Senator Cruz
yes.
will be carrying it. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3470. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2510.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2510A, the lease 15-year limit on veterans' use of preference in public employment.
This is Paula Brown again, I guess.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's holiday.
It's a holiday.
For the record, my name is Paula Brown, the Deputy Director at the Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2510, which deletes the 25-year limit on a veteran's use of preference in public hiring, in effect making the veteran's preference a lifetime benefit. Since the time of the Civil War, veterans of the armed forces have been given some degree of preference in appointments to federal jobs. Recognizing their sacrifice, Congress enacted laws to prevent veterans seeking federal employment from being penalized for their time in military service. Veterans Preference recognizes the economic loss suffered by citizens who have served their country in uniform, restores veterans to a favorable competitive position for government employment, and acknowledges the larger obligation owed to disabled veterans. Veterans Preference in its present form comes from the Veterans Preference Act of 1944. When the Veterans Preference was enacted, the American workforce was one of stability. Veterans routinely found employment and remained with the company for their entire career. The time limit put on use of the Veterans Preference seemed quite reasonable under these circumstances, in that a veteran should have been able to find a public employment career within the time limit that was established at that time. However, today's job market is quite different, as we all know. It's more transient. Most workers do not stay with a company for their entire career. In fact, it is not uncommon for a worker to change jobs once every 5 years for various reasons related to both the employer and the employee. Eliminating the time period for using veterans' preference points in public hiring would help a number of veterans, especially middle-aged veterans, who may have been laid off from their private sector job or are seeking a career change and have been out of the military service for more than 15 years. It's important to note that the veteran's preference does not guarantee a job to a veteran, nor is it an affirmative action type system. Veteran's preference simply provides points to be used in the hiring process to ensure that the veteran is competitive when applying for public sector positions. Veterans have much to offer the public sector employment, and we believe that veterans' preference should be a lifetime benefit for them. I appreciate the committee hearing this bill, and I would be happy to answer questions.
Even in the regular sector, I remember I changed jobs every 3 to 5 years until I was 40 and then finally slowed down a little bit. So I think this is very valuable. Is there any other discussion? All right, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2510A and open a work session on House Bill 2510A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2510A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2510A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Please note Senator Bates as excused, and on the last bill, on all these bills, he's been excused. Sorry, I haven't been excusing him and haven't had. Okay.
If there's no further discussion, note Senator Bates is excused, and motion carries, and I will carry this bill, unless there's someone else who would like to carry it.
It's your turn.
All right. With that, I'll carry it, and we're closing the House Bill 2510A, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2165A.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2165A authorizes the governor to...
Oh, wait. Oh, look. Before we do this, we have Representative Clem here.
We're waiting for some other people.
Are you waiting for some other people?
Maybe you already passed the bill. We're going
to
go home.
No. Okay. Let's open a public...
We'll close first.
Oh, yeah. Close a public hearing on 2165 and open a public hearing on HJM 8. Mr. Shirk?
Madam Chair, HJM 8A urges Board of Governors of the United States Postal Service and Citizens Stamp Advisory Committee to create a postage stamp commemorating 100th Infantry Battalion and 442 Regimental Combat Team of the United States Army for service during World War II.
All right. Representative Clem.
Yes, please. Was there a handout on 2510 PDF? Because we didn't get one.
Sorry, I'm trying to recover from it.
You can take a picture from here if you want, so you get them.
It's my mom.
I know. You can right behind the dais there from the angle is fine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. I'm going to allow my most important constituent to begin, and my dear friend, Mr. Evans, who has some really great comments, I think, to share about this a memorial, and then I would just finish up if that's even necessary.
Wonderful.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Carol Suzuki, and I'm here today as a proud niece of the 442nd, proud niece of a 442nd 100th Battalion Company A veteran. I'm a Sansei, a third-generation Japanese American, and I have served on the Oregon Commission on Asian Affairs since 2001. Last May, when my husband, Representative Brian Clem, and I spoke to Jeff Selby regarding he is president of the Portland chapter of the Japanese American Citizens League. He brought up his idea of a bill to Congress requesting a stamp honoring the veterans of the 442nd and the Military Intelligence Service, and I became very excited about the prospect of being a part of this effort, and it turns out it's a grassroots effort that started in California. Growing up in Hood River, I had no idea that a number of my father's friends, who I only knew as farmers and orchardists in the valley, were also decorated veterans of the 442nd and the MIS. And so over the years, more and more stories of their heroic efforts have been coming to light, and I'm so thankful to be here today speaking to you on this bill. My late uncle, Yoriaki Tambera, was a native Oregonian who was born in Metolius, Oregon, and was a graduate of Bend High School. He enlisted in 1944 and was a member of the 100th Infantry Battalion and the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and served primarily in Italy. And while my Uncle Yori was never wounded or received medals for his service, I have no doubt that it took incredible courage to enlist and serve, knowing that war casualties were high and that he may never make it home to his young bride, my Aunt Kiku, who he met and married while in prison in camp. And he, like the rest of the Nisei veterans of this period, literally fought for the right to fight for their country, even as they faced extreme racism, humiliation, incarceration, and other challenges by their own government and fellow citizens who can question their loyalty to the United States. And one last note I wanted to make, we are losing our World War II veterans far too quickly. At our House hearing, noted historian Linda Tamura shared that there are 16 million Americans who served in the armed forces during World War II, and they are dying at a rate of over 1,000 a day. And this statistic was given back in 2003 by the Department of Veterans Affairs. So obviously time is critical, and I hope you'll help us send this message to the United States Postal Service and to Congress. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you. My father was a World War II veteran, and he died just in October. He's one of those that are part of that, who are leaving us. So, and we did honor those World War II veterans by naming the highway. I forget the highway 97. 97. Yes. Yeah, I was trying to think what that was. So, yes.
Chair Moss Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Paul Evans, and actually today I'm not here in the capacity of the governor's policy advisor. I'm here in the capacity of a veteran of OIF and OEF, somebody who spent 17 years in the military. And I just want to briefly, because I know we're short on time, say what an honor it is to sit here today on this particular bill, both with friends I care about and on an issue that I think is important. The story of the 442nd, most people have heard little bits and pieces of. If you've not really looked at what that group of individuals did, it's truly worth your time. It's the most decorated unit in American military history. At the darkest moment of the American response to World War II, these people, understanding that scared people do dumb things, didn't believe in the America that was, but rather could be. They put aside the humiliation. They put aside people thinking the worst of them because of their heritage, because they believed that America was yet to be formed, that it was stronger than its parts, and that it was worth the sacrifice. This unit actually enjoyed 300% casualties in its combat time. That means that for every person in the unit, there were approximately 3 Purple Hearts awarded. Now, not everybody got a Purple Heart. Some people got 4 and 5. But the bottom line is there was no more aggressive, no more supportive unit in the European theater than the 442nd. Those of us that have worn the uniform since have a great and a special place in our heart for the approach that those men took, even in training. They exceeded the standards and showcased that not only could they be trusted, but they, in fact, would be very effective at what they did. And it is beyond my understanding, quite frankly, that the Postal Service hasn't already done this. We have stamps for all kinds of things that make no sense to me. But this is one of those things that I think will send a clear signal of what a hero really is. And I think it will send a clear signal from Oregon that we are stronger than the individual parts, and that the fact that even in this dark chapter people recognized what America could be worth and were willing to stand up for that is a value that we need to get back in touch with, and I think a stamp is a first step in doing that. So, again, I'll keep it brief. Just thank you for this opportunity. It's not just a stamp. It's a symbol and a signal of what is right about our country. So, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
It's interesting, having grown up in Montana, I knew some Japanese Americans who went to an internment camp. My daughter lives in Ontario, Oregon, and there are a number of Japanese Americans who served in the military. And my sister is also a World War II veteran who's still alive and well.
Good. So.
But I think it was such a great injustice that happened, and I think that we do need to honor veterans who did serve.
Madam Chair, I'm not even sure I identified myself when I...
Oh, we all know who you are.
Well, please re-identify yourself if you didn't.
Brian Clam, House District 21 here in Salem. The one thing that's interesting that I sort of bring to this is after we did the resolution, a reporter from the Oregonian called the Postal Service and asked them, so, you know, are these resolutions making a difference? And where is Mr. Roy Betts? Mr. Roy Betts, the supposedly community relations manager for the Postal Service, rejected the call, saying it doesn't honor specific military units. And then he said he'd shared the letters concerning the stamp with the advisory committee, but he wrote in an email, it's not on the agenda to be reconsidered. So that obviously irritated me, something awful. My dad delivered mail for 42 years for this postal service. He and I are talking about going to one of their meetings and giving back all the retirement, you know, hats and pins and things if they don't at some point issue the stamp. But from that time to now, the House passed a resolution. It's obviously here in front of you, your memorial. But Senators Merkley and Wyden both wrote a very strong letter arguing that they should reconsider their decision, and in fact listing 7 military units, including the Buffalo Soldiers, women in military service, the United Confederate Veterans, a whole sheet of 10 different stamps with different folks, all countering what they claim they don't do with stamps. And then they did give the Simpsons one like 2 weeks after we were had our bill. So this is a campaign that is ongoing, and if you know anybody in the White House or the Stamp Advisory Committee, they could use a phone call. But I'm hopeful that this effort and the help of our congressional delegation and other friends around the country, we're going to be able to get the least really of things would at least be a stamp to honor their contribution. But it means a lot to these veterans, and it's not a huge no one's asking for a payment to them or anything else. They did it to defend and fight for their country, and I would just like to see the stamp be issued.
Thank you very much. I think many of us who grew up in Oregon knew have many, many Japanese American friends who served and also who were interred. So thank you very much. Is there any other further discussion? I think that's all who signed up to testify. Is that correct? Is there anyone else to testify in HJM 8? All right. With that, I'd like to close public hearing on HJM 8 and open a work session on HJM 8.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 8 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves HJM 8 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? And please note Senator Bates is excused. Since there's no opposition, that motion carries. Senator Morissette, would you carry this?
Yeah.
This would be great. All right, Senator Morissette will carry, and I will close the work session on HJM 8 and reopen a public hearing on House Bill 2165.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2165A allows the governor to authorize certain members of Oregon National Guard to provide health care services when the governor declares certain emergencies.
And who's here to speak on, let's see, 2165? Where's the witness sheet?
Paul Evans, I think, is one.
Just you. Paul Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Evans, and I'm back in the policy advisor to Governor Kulongoski's for emergency services, military, and veterans role. Because of time, I'm going to try to actually channel, hopefully successfully, Brigadier General Caldwell, Ken Murphy, and all the other emergency management folks. House Bill 2165 is a very simple bill. It's one of the, we see as one of the low-hanging fruit bills that we can do during this session to be more prepared for a potential crisis. Simply put, it allows us to use trained military medical personnel during a time of emergency that the governor has declared. You would think we could do that right now. Ironically, we can't. There's a lot of legal reasons and some insurance things that are tied to it. We simply want to be able to use folks that we know are capable of almost field-level hospital care to be able to do what we need to do during times of significant crisis. That's the bill. I would try to answer questions you have.
I think you did a really good job of channeling.
What is health? I mean, what type of health care?
Medics. So I'll give you a scenario. During the Vernonia floods, for example, we could send medics in there to help rescue people off roofs, but they couldn't treat the people. Even though it was the governor's declared and there were no other medics there.
But what type of treatment? There isn't a liability issue here.
It could be
here.
A triage more than anything, I would assume.
Triage and basic care. I mean, yeah. They could not act in the capacity of a medic. They could treat our guys if they were hurt. But if they saw a citizen hurt, they couldn't treat them.
And these are trained?
Trained medics. They go through.
That's amazing.
Army, Air Force, trained medical, different IDMT for the Air Force side, and the Army has a program as well. But these are folks that we send to combat to treat wounds during combat. They couldn't help people with a hurt leg or things like that during Vernonia. It was a surprise to us as well.
we have a registry too. In fact, we passed a bill to say out-of-state people could help out-of-state licensed people. I think we need to talk with the Department of Human Services to see if even the names of our paramedics could go on that registry.
A little later today, in fact, there's a bill that kind of works on some of that. But I absolutely agree. If we can use a tool that's in the box, we should be able to use it. And this bill would allow us to do that.
All righty. Well, will you talk with Katie King, Grant Higginson, on the,
yes, ma'am.
On the registry that the state already has,
yep,
to see if there can be... it would be very beneficial so that...
Yes, Chairman Sanderson, we will continue those talks, and right now we're actually taking a directive inside the military department to make sure our medics are on that registry. But right now there's some folks that just aren't yet.
Okay. Well, I'd like DHS, I would love to get DHS's input on this also. Is there someone from DHS?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Leopold. I am the director of the Oregon Emergency Medical Services and Trauma Systems Program in the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services.
And it's Robert?
Robert Leopold. L-E-O-P-O-L-D.
All right.
So I believe the registry you're talking about is the Emergency Volunteer Registry. We are working with a preparedness group to have all the emergency medical technicians, paramedics, and the other folks integrated into that so they have the opportunity to volunteer.
Excellent.
It's going to take a little while to get the two computer systems to talk to each other, but it should happen in the next few months.
Wonderful. Glad to hear you're ahead of the game. All right. Is there any other further discussion on House Bill 2165? With that, I'd like to close the work session, public hearing on House Bill 2165 and open a work session on House Bill 2165.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2165 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2165 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? No, Senator Bates is excused. With no opposition, the motion carries. And Senator Cruz? Yeah, Senator Cruz will carry this bill. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2165, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3097.
Madam Chair, just to take a second, on these veterans bills that we've been passing, I'd like to publicly acknowledge Mr. David Molina, who's in our audience today, who's the committee administrator for the House Veterans Affairs Committee and has done a super job. Our offices are right next to each other, and he has been a tremendous help in helping not only his own committee but helping this committee get up to speed on all of the veterans-related issues and writing all the summaries. So I appreciate that, and thank you very much, David.
Excellent. All right. With that, I'd like to call Robert Leopold, Will Bosher, and Sean Baird all together.
Madam Chair, House Bill 3097A directs Department of Human Services to adopt rules to allow emergency medical technician applicant to substitute experience and certification by National Registry of Emergency Medical Technicians for certain requirements imposed by the department. Madam Chair, we have a representative, Matthews' office is here to also testify.
Oh, I should.
Even though Representative Matthews is not here, his representative is.
All right. I'll have you after this panel then, Andy. Is that all right?
Yep.
Okay, all right. Thank you. Whoever's first.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Leopold. This feels a little like deja vu. I am the director of the Oregon Emergency Medical Services and Trauma Systems Program in the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. I am here today to testify in support of House Bill 3097A. 3097A is a product of a work group convened by Representative Matthews. 3097A directs the EMS and Trauma Systems Office to develop rules which recognize experience in lieu of a degree for individuals who are already certified in another state and are seeking certification in Oregon. The applicants would still be required to be nationally registered to demonstrate competency, and they would still have to have a criminal background check. The department appreciates the leadership Representative Matthews showed on this issue and supports House Bill 3097A. Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Will Boucher. I am the one of the directors with the Oregon Fire Medical Administrators, which is in essence the EMS section of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, and I'm here representing both organizations today. We too are here in support of the bill before you. Our organizations are very supportive of the significant educational requirements that have been established here in Oregon for its emergency medical technicians. However, we also recognize that there are times and situations where flexibility is indicated and required, and this bill before you would allow some of the, that flexibility through administrative rule. I'll keep my comments short and brief, so with that, I'll thank you for your consideration and answer any questions that you may have.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Sean Baird. I'm a paramedic and owner of Woodburn Ambulance Service, and I'm president of the Oregon State Ambulance Association. We're very supportive of 3097A. We have had over the years growing difficulty in recruiting paramedics, in particularly in our rural, out-of-the-valley communities, and this bill would allow for reciprocity to take place, recognizing significant field and clinical experience as well as national registry, which is the same high standard bar that we use in Oregon for certifying our paramedics. We think this is a great way to allow reciprocity without lowering any standards, and at the same time, we appreciate we've worked with the Health Division staff, with Mr. Leipold and Dr. Ritu Sani over the last couple of years to try to streamline the certification process, and we see this as one more step in allowing that to happen.
As you know, there's opposition to this bill, and I'd like your comments on this. They felt that, and I think someone will be here to testify, but I would like your input, that this is was the intent primarily for the benefit of military veterans, or is this for all out-of-state paramedic applicants?
We believe that this would, this is to apply to all out-of-state paramedic applicants, in the process also addressing issues with military veterans. Some levels of training with the military do not coincide exactly with the civilian training that a paramedic would receive, and part of that rulemaking process would be to identify what those areas are and if there are any gaps. Identify what requirements would need to be picked up. On the civilian side, for out-of-state applicants who are currently nationally registered, all of those people have achieved the same level of clinical and field internship training from an institution of training that meets the same standards for Oregon paramedic training. The only difference would be whether or not they were required to either have a degree in any field, by the way, not just in EMS. So it could be in a liberal arts background or something else. It's a supplemental piece that's unique to Oregon. That's the part that we would like to be able to substitute some depth of experience in the field for.
Okay. Current wording allows lesser trained out-of-state paramedics to take jobs away from Oregon trained paramedics?
I can't imagine how that would be. The training program to be for the National Registry to allow you to take their examination, you have to have met the benchmarks for training that are the same from a national standard paramedic curriculum. And perhaps Mr. Leipold could speak to that.
Madam Chairman, we used the two standards I described. National Registry, we recognize four levels of emergency provider: first responders, EMT basics, EMT intermediates, and EMT paramedics. For first responders, basics, and paramedics, we essentially have adopted a national standard. Oregon intermediates, we created something to attempt to address the specific circumstances in Oregon. For paramedics, basics, and first responders, I don't believe the training standard is less in other states because it has to be consistent with the national registry standards or they couldn't be certified.
Thank you very much. Any other discussion on this?
Madam Chair, reciprocity in Oregon has always been an issue, and we bar a lot of people from this state just because we set an arbitrary standard.
Any other questions? All right, Paul.
Not just on this bill. Yeah. There are other areas as well.
Andy Darkins and Paul Evans and Johnny Mack.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andy Darkins. I'm a legislative assistant to Representative Greg Matthews, House District 50, Gresham. I'm here to testify on House Bill 3097. This bill is the product of a work group between all interested stakeholders. We sat down with the Department of Human Services, members of the House of Representatives, Paul Evans, instructor from Chemeketa Community College, and initially the purpose of this bill was to help returning military veterans who were seeking to become certified as emergency medical technicians. But from our work in the work group, we realized this really wasn't going to be possible, and there were a number of difficulties writing something like this into statute. So we thought it best to write something a little more broad, but still to direct the Department of Human Services to establish certification standards that took experience into account. To address a couple of the concerns raised by Bob McLean, Gary McLean, this bill is not anti-labor. I think Representative Matthews, with a long background in labor, and as the president of Gresham Firefighters 1062, can tell you he's not going to do anything anti-labor. There was a concern raised in their testimony that perhaps EMTs could go on strike and out-of-state EMTs could come in and break the strike, and Bob Leopold can also attest that it takes more than a couple of days to certify an EMT in the state, and something like that really is impossible. I'm free to answer any other questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Evans. I'm policy advisor to Governor Kunkowski for military and veterans issues. I'll keep my remarks very brief. We started out with this bill exactly as Andy talked about, in terms of under the idea of reintegration, because we have a number of folks coming back from the war, from active duty and the Guard and Reserve, that have had tremendous field experience and have a hard time in their own mind justifying why they have to go back to school and learn basic medic when they've literally been doing field triage and in some cases field surgery under the worst cases imaginable. One of the things that's important to realize, at least from our perspective on this, is that all the bad things that go with war also produce one very interesting thing, and that is, after Vietnam, as I understand it, the current medic program that we enjoy now came out of Vietnam because of the folks in the field learning different things that they could find civilian applications for. We may not realize it right now, but I want to tell you one thing. The National Guard that you have right now in Oregon is the most combat seasoned organization that this country, at least this Oregon country, has ever had. 5 to 6 years of sustained combat operations. We have folks out there that are medics that have had all kinds of experiences that you can't sometimes even read about yet because people couldn't believe they would happen. And it just seems to me a loss if there isn't some flexibility to be able to pour those life experiences into the workforce, especially in the rural areas where a lot of our Guard, Reserve, and veterans live. So the Governor's Office very much supports this bill. We absolutely appreciate the work of Bob Leopold, of Representative Matthews, and of Sean and the ambulance guys that have been coming together to do this. Clearly, we don't think it's an anti-labor issue. We rather see it as an opportunity to get folks into the workforce faster and to save lives. This is an important bill. We see it, again, as part of that overall readiness and emergency preparedness agenda, and I would try to answer any questions you might have.
Hi, Madam Chair and
Members of the committee, my name is Johnny Mack. I'm the Associate Dean of Emergency Services at Chemeketa Community College, and as the Associate Dean and sponsoring college of the statewide degree, I'm here to speak on behalf of House Bill 3097 and the EMT Consortium of the educators in the state of Oregon are in favor of this bill. And we don't see it as regressing backwards, but most of these people that will come in will continue to get their education and earn their degree. And we do allow credits for professional certification, so most of these people coming out of the military and from other states, in order to promote up, will continue to seek their education and earn their associate degree or their bachelor's degree. So we are in favor of this.
How many EMT schools or training sites are there in the state?
There is all 17 community colleges in Oregon can offer the EMT basic and intermediate, as well as there's a couple private schools and OHSU. And then there's currently 9 paramedic schools in Oregon. Not all the community colleges offer the paramedic, but Umpqua, Rogue, Southwestern, Oregon, Chemeketa, Portland Community College, Central Oregon Community College, and then OHSU, and then there's a private school in the Portland metro area.
So if someone comes, say, out of state or from the military, and how will this bill expedite them getting, do they have to still get some training, or... It says it takes it into account, but...
Right. Well, presently, Oregon is only one of 2 states in the nation which require an emergency medical technician who is a paramedic to receive an associate's degree.
Oh.
So, for example, if we have a paramedic working in Colorado who served 8 years and would like to come to Oregon to work as a paramedic, despite all the experience and work they performed in Colorado, if they don't have their associate's degree, they still have to go back to a community college and get that 2-year degree. We think this bill could potentially expedite some of that coursework, time, and money spent, instead of that, just continuing to work and serve as a paramedic.
Great. Further discussion? All right. Thank you very much. Stick around in case we need to ask you some questions. Gary McLean and Lynn Learbach.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Gary McLean, and I'm the current president of the Oregon State Paramedic Association. I'm a firefighter, union shop steward, and 33 years experience as a paramedic in Oregon. The legislative process is, in this level of politics, is relatively new to me, but I'm here to try and do my best and tell you our side of it. When House Bill 3097 was originally discussed in work group, and we were in that work group, as you were told here, we were told that the primary intent was to make it easier for our returning military corpsmen to become Oregon paramedics. We were told that House Bill 3097 would benefit the troops. And for that purpose, and that purpose only, we supported the bill's intent. Yet the bill that you have in front of you now has changed from about a 6-page document to just this one small paragraph. And as you can see in the current bill's wording, there is no mention of veterans at all. Its impact now goes way beyond veterans to include about 15,000 paramedics across the United States that might be interested in coming here. All those paramedics have different experience, and we will have to evaluate each one of those individuals' experience if this bill passes. That's a huge workload for the Health Division to do. The bill's original intent has been lost, and we stated our opposition in verbal and written testimony on the House side. If the primary goal is to help returning military corpsmen become paramedics, we have proposed wording. We did send that wording to Senator Matthew's office. It's kind of late in the game. I know that. We haven't heard back from him. But you do have that in front of you, which we added under the proposed wording. We added a military veteran defined in ORS. We added military medical training and experience. And that experience and training can be used as a portion of the educational requirements as imposed by the department. We added the words military veteran. We would support this bill if these or like words were added. We're here to support the troops. I was in two branches of the military. However, if House Bill 3097's purpose is to open our borders and drop our standards, we stand opposed. We stated our concerns during work groups and verbal written testimony. We have not waffled in our opposition at all. We were also told that no other state had established a degree requirement for paramedics. And as such, Oregon was no longer a leader, but we had just created a barrier for paramedics moving to Oregon. This is simply not true. Both Texas and Kansas have both implemented an associate degree paramedic licensure levels. Oregon may be the first, but other states are beginning to follow. There are currently over 370 by yesterday's count, 350 paramedic programs across the United States that train to the associate degree level. So Oregon isn't just, we may be one of three states right now that require that, but these training programs are across the country. Why would so many colleges and training centers teach to that level if that's not where we're headed? And in 2002, the Oregon Supreme Court declared paramedics professional. And in an opinion authored by Justice Gillette, paramedics, and I quote, are required to have special learning, 2 years of training that provides them not only with physical skills to perform procedures, but also the intellectual skills to recognize symptoms and to make split-second decisions. House Bill 3097 drops our educational standard, just as other states are starting to realize the future of this profession. The bill's downside, and one of the questions on labor, is that the current wording allows lesser-trained, out-of-state paramedics to take jobs away from Oregon-trained paramedics. This came up in the work group because we did hear at least one person that was there that said, I would hire somebody from out of state who had 3 years of experience or more over somebody who just graduated from one of our associate degree paramedic programs in Oregon. So in theory, a person can come in because they have experience. Now, an Oregon paramedic who has an associate degree, has met that associate degree requirement and has 3 years of experience, I'll put them up against any paramedic in the country. But just to say that somebody has experience to come in from out of state, and for them to tell us they want to come to Oregon, they have experience, but they're not interested in any further education, that does not tell me that that's necessarily the type of paramedics that we want in Oregon. Oregon paramedics have a 98% pass rate on the national registry's written exams, well above the national average of 78%. One of the causes of that is that we require everybody to take that associate degree program. This bill creates two unequal standards for our licensure, one that is higher for Oregon paramedics and lower for out-of-state paramedics. If the original intent of House Bill 3097 was to help our returning veterans, we have provided wording that we think addresses that. However, if the bill is to allow other out-of-state paramedics, which are primarily non-veterans, to come in here, and lower our standards for those people, and we stand opposed. Please consider our request, and thank you for allowing us to give testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Lerbach.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. My name is Len Lerbach. I represent the Joint Council of Teamsters. We now represent EMTs, so we're here in support of Gary McLean's testimony. I would add just a few things here. One, listening to previous testimony, I think it was Robert Leopold that said he wasn't sure of the training in other states, so neither are we, and I'm sure you'd want to be what the training is in other states if we're going to lower the requirements and let someone else from another state come in here. We certainly want to know their trained people and what that training consists of, and it may be very different between the states. So I think take that into very strong consideration. I would like a comment that was made from Representative Matthews' office. We don't think Representative Matthews is anti-labor, nor do we think you up there are anti-labor. That's not why we're here. We're here with the concerns that the state would lower what is already in effect and been very effective, the requirements that one would have to be a EMT or a paramedic. I know that if an ambulance pulls up to my door, I want to be looking in the eyes if I'm still looking, and be able to trust that driver, that EMT, that paramedic, that he is properly trained and that I can trust him to take care of me until I get to the hospital for sure. And we've done a good job here in Oregon. And that associate's degree shows a lot of things. It shows an atmosphere, a desire, a training and learning. And once achieved, it shows they've done that. So I think it's a very important requirement. Hopefully it's in related sciences to medical training that associate's degree is in. But even if it isn't, that person showed that they had the ability, the desire, and took the time to get an associate's degree. So I don't believe it should be removed. And we are all in support of military veterans returning. I'm also a veteran. I'm a Korean veteran. But having said that, I think they should also be tested as to their degree of experience when they come out of the military. Certainly that should be honored, and we stand in support of that. But there should be a degree of experience that they do provide, and they ought to be tested by this state before they're just, okay, you had experience, and we're going to give you a certificate. So we'd like to you all to take that into consideration, and I'm glad to answer any questions that you all may have. And thank you for
As you know, as Senator Cruz said, reciprocity is a real issue. I had my nursing training in Virginia, and I actually worked as a public health nurse in the state of Virginia for 3 or 4 years before I came here. So reciprocity is extremely important, and I was so glad that the state of Oregon didn't say that my training at Radford University in the state of Virginia wasn't as good as one at OHSU or Mount Hood Community College. We had heard testimony that, especially in the rural areas, it's difficult to recruit, and yet you're saying that we have ample paramedics.
Well, I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that question, that we have ample, but I would certainly think it's a desirable field out there. I'm not sure. And if it's not, then we would help recruit out of high school kids that possibly or even out of college, kids that want to be doctors and nurses that maybe don't meet quite the requirements, or they don't make it through that part of their schooling, that then they should be aimed over to be trained as EMTs or paramedics, at least led to that. We should all be working on going into the high schools, showing that this is a field that, hey, there's work available, and there'll be work available in the future. But on reciprocity, and I respect what you said, Chair Anderson, but I think we want to be very careful about, well, you may have been trained in a very good state that had good requirements, but I don't know all states have that, and I'm very apprehensive that they do. So,
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. This is a very simple bill. It's 4 lines. Will you point to me in those 4 lines where it says we're lowering standards?
Are you asking me, sir?
Yeah. I mean, it's 4 lines. I read and reread and reread, and I can't find where it says we're lowering standards.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, currently in administrative rule, most of these items that we're talking about are already in administrative rule. Administrative rule requires paramedics in Oregon to have an associate degree, and has so since 1999. This statute actually says that we would replace that requirement or substitute experience and certification by the National Registry for educational requirements imposed by the department. right now the only education requirement per se that's required by DHS is at the paramedic level, and that's the associate degree since 1999. So this statute just really specifically looks at that.
Well, I'm going to try. I just don't see, you know, obviously rules are going to be written and standards are going to be set. I just don't see how this bill is lowering standards. You may assume that, but with the oversight we have over process, I seriously doubt that the health department is going to want to lower standards. It's more of an access issue. So,
any questions? All right. Thank you very much. I'll be carrying this bill over, if that's all right. Want to make sure that I talk with all members individually about this bill, and I will close. Oh, yeah.
I'd be the last one to question a Scribner's spelling. But do we have two spellings for endorsement and endorsement?
Oh.
Oh, that is spelling. I will talk to Andy Darkins to please look at the spelling of endorsement on line 5. And we may want to have that corrected also. All right. Thank you.
Chair, there are two definitions of endorsement.
Yeah.
One is certificate of endorsement, which is the I. The other one is an endorsement for a campaign or something, which is the E.
Oh, really?
There are actually two definitions.
So this is the appropriate one.
A world of knowledge to my left.
I want to thank Mr. Molina for straightening that out yesterday, as I also had the same question.
Never mind, then.
I learned something.
I did, too.
Me, too.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3097, and I will open a public hearing on 2435.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2435A, carried over from 412, requires the Executive Director of Oregon Medical Board to issue limited licenses to qualified physicians tending to work in certain rural areas. In your packet, you'll see an amendment drafted and presented yesterday, and I believe it's the work of the stakeholders, and we'll review that this morning.
All right. Who is on the...
Kathleen, I believe.
Kathleen, yeah.
Let's see.
Courtney, Glenn.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Board. And I believe you have House Bill 2435A8 in front of you, and it
I knew it would have to be an 8. I knew Bates couldn't get down there in time.
I believe it reflects the discussion we had the other day and represents a collaboration between all the parties that will address the issue. So thank you, and we're happy to answer any questions.
No other comments?
Madam Chair, my...
Wait, we don't have now a fiscal for the 8-8.
No, we do not. We discussed this yesterday.
But I would say that my issues have been addressed, and thank you very much.
So your issues have been addressed? That's wonderful. Well, then, what were your issues?
My issue was having an actual defined claim on malpractice. We needed to be flexible on that because, as I read it, 50 is probably a low figure at this point in time and would be incredibly low.
50,000.
Yeah, probably 5 years from now. So that's a minor claim at this point.
Mm-hmm. So basically what the change was that there is no... reference to
it says significant malpractice claim, so that
could you just point it out
on lines 19 and 20
may not have been held liable for a significant malpractice
that
claim
allows for flexibility
as defined by the board
rule,
The board won't have problems in defining this.
Chair Mona Sanderson, no, we won't.
Madam Chair, yeah. Senator Bates had a question about continuous, and I think you've addressed that
right
in line 14 or 15. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yes. And Chair Montes-Anderson, this is Gwen Dayton with the Hospital Association. The other significant change in these amendments versus the original set of the gotten stuff amendments on this bill are to, at Senator Bates' suggestion, include recent retirees in as eligible to participate in the endorsement process.
And just a question on that. If the physician is retired, must have been retired for 1 year or less, is that really important? Why not 5 years or less?
Chair Montes-Anderson, that's a very good question. The board has found that skill level in the clinical area decreases with time and probably to some extent with age, and so that 1 year is important to the board.
All righty. And again, I just have not, I'm fine with this amendment, but I take a look at myself only as a nurse who's been out of now practice since I've been in the legislature, except I'm
That's
still
a long time.
Eight years. Yet I've been able to keep my license active because I'm doing so much health care policy. So that is why I'm able to do my keep my license. And so I'm so glad, because if I'm not reelected, I want to be able to get back into nursing without to go through. But it will be certain areas that I would be focusing on. Anyway, I just, it's too bad that we can't have more flexibility. I'm not sure, though, with a physician, if there are skill sets that they would have without actually doing actual practice of where their skills might not be up to par.
But Madam Chair, they could retire and still keep their license active,
right,
same as you are. So that wouldn't be an issue.
Oh, it is. Is that correct?
Chair Montes-Anderson, you can not be actively practicing. We do have an active license, and we expect that the licensee is practicing, but we're not going out and monitoring whether or not they're practicing, in fact. So you're right, Senator Cruz, that someone could have an active license and be doing administrative medicine or something
right,
like that. And I think that's what we would consider what you're doing under your license is administrative.
That's right.
Important policy work.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think
sounds
that's
like a conflict of interest.
Oh, I will state my conflict of interest here. I'm not a doctor, though, so this won't relate to me. Okay, yes, Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, my Scribner question is still open.
Endorsement
in the same context is spelled differently here than it was in the previous bill.
Can you call Elsie? This is our last bill, and get someone down here that will explain to us
what,
the I and
no,
the E.
Sure, it's not
what line?
I don't know.
Yeah, what line
that,
is it?
That should not nullify the bill.
No, it won't
well,
nullify
it's
the bill.
Line 9.
Well, it's used in several places. line 9, line 10.
Right, that's endorsement with an E? Yeah, line 13. License by endorsement?
No.
Also on 13.
13. So
I still, we could call Elsie. We still have a few
and
minutes.
And on line 12 on page 2.
Have that clarified for us.
Okay.
And line what?
Line 12 on page 2.
I hate to be nitpicking, Madam Chair, but it...
Right, let's pull out the last bill. And the last bill was which one? 3097? So that we, when LC gets here, we can ask them to why it was...
Why it's a one-way and one and...
An I and...
It appears to be in the same context, Madam Chair.
Yeah, it does appear to be in the same context. So we'll be at ease. meeting, the meeting, the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs, and we are considering House Bill 2435. Is there any more discussion on House Bill 2435?
Madam Chair, do you want to adopt the dash
I
and then wait for that?
Are we in work session, though?
No.
No. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2435, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2435.
Madam Chair, I move adoption of the dash A8 amendment to House Bill 2435.
Senator Cruz moves the adoption of the A8s into House Bill 2435. And just for clarification, we did have legislative council come to us, and the I and the E in the words endorsement, it's interchangeable. It's just that some statutes have the I and some statutes have the E, so we don't need to be concerned about the I and the E. So is there any other further discussion on House Bill 2435? Clerk will call the roll on the amendment.
Senator Bates?
Excused.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair
Monica
Anderson?
Aye. Motion carries.
Madam Chair, I would question, we can still do rule suspension. There's no fiscal on this.
Right.
Rather than wait, could we just suspend the rules and move
We need unanimous, and we don't.
So,
is that unanimous present, or do we need a full?
Just unanimous of those present.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of passing House Bill 2435 without a fiscal statement.
All right. Senator Cruz moves that we suspend the rules so that we can pass this bill without a fiscal. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Okay. So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill.
Suspend the rules.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2435 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Yes, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2435 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Note that Senator Bates is excused and it is passed. And Senator Cruz, would you like to... it's passed and Senator Cruz will... Motion carried. Now, Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2435, and we're adjourned. Thank you.